Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein, and this week we will be speaking about Tchelis. This week the Torah spoke about the Parsha of Tzitzis, so we will be speaking about what is arguably the biggest breakthrough in a mitzvah, maybe in 1,000 years, and we will have with us the great Gaon, Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, who Moshe Feinstein called Yedidi. And he is counter Tchelis, the new discovery. We will have from Lakewood, New Jersey, Rabbi Yisrael Barkin, who will present us with maybe 10 or 15 proofs that this is the current Tchelis. And we will have from Yerushalayim, Rabbi Nachum Eisenstein, opining on this as well. You can find all our programs at headlinestorah.com. We also have a new app, and you can download it. It's Headlines Radio Show, in one word, Headlines Radio Show. And if you download it in the past, you should update it, because now it has a slide bar, so you can jump to any place you'd like to in the program. Now, additionally, what we started a number of weeks ago, and we'll do this week as well, is the initial interview with the Rabbanim goes usually very often longer than the hour. For example, in Tchelis, we have an hour 40. So on the app, you'll be able to pick up the entire program, which is longer than what we broadcast here on the radio. You can always call in on our hotline, 732-806-8700. You can email any questions to info@headlinesbook.com. I'd like to put in a small ad. You know, from the Headlines program, we've also printed 2 books. And the last one, the first one, was the all-time bestseller for the OU. This one, I hope, will top the first one. It's called Headlines 2. Some of the, you know, of our best programs were on there. DNA as halachic evidence. If Kim Davis were Orthodox, she issue a marriage license to same-sex couples? What is the definition today of what is an apikoiris? What do we do with the disgraced rabbi? Unfortunately, that in the news. Criminals in Shul. Should convicted felons be welcome in our communities? Unfortunately, we have so many of them dealing with the criminals in our community. We talk about fathering a child after death, the newest medical breakthroughs, artificial insemination for an unmarried woman. And we bring all the Rabbanim. In these articles, we bring all the Rabbanim. Could a doctor endanger himself to treat a patient? Aborting a fetus infected with the Zika virus, OCD in halacha, seducing the enemy, killing neutralized terrorists, Shabbos mode ovens, Ben Pakua meat, sherry cask whiskeys, all our favorite shows, Headlines too. Go pick it up before it's sold out. This week's parsha is Shlach, and Shlach is about fear. The spies, they were afraid of entering the promised land. And what happens? We see a confrontation. What did they say? Lainu chalalais, we can't reach the promised land. And what does Kalev say? Yachel nuchala, we can. With faith, with amuna, with perseverance, with passion, right? Yeshua, koish yacha, with amuna, kalev is kulei lev, with passion, we can conquer what we were supposed to. Yachel nuchala. So this parsha is about fear, and the fear that keeps every one of us from reaching our promised land, from fulfilling our potential. The two miraglim in our head that say, you can't do it, you can't do it, it's too hard, it's too complicated, you're not smart enough. This parsha is about conquering fear. And I want to talk about 2 people. Sara Shanira, it's 100 years. In 1917, she founded the first Beis Yaakov. You know who Sara Shanira was? She was a girl, single girl, a Belza Chassidista. This is what she writes. As we pass through the Yamim Neiraim, the High Holy Days, fathers and sons travel to Ger, Alexander, Babov. She writes this in Poland, circa 1910. All those places that had made citadels of conceited religious life, dominated by the figure of a Rebbe's personality. But we stay at home, the wives, the daughters, the little ones. We have an empty yomtiv. It's beer of Jewish intellectual content. The women never learned anything about spiritual meaning that is concentrated in a Jewish yomtiv. The mother goes to the synagogue. The services echo faintly in a fenced, boarded-off women's gallery. There is crying by the elderly women. The young girls look at them as if they belong to a different century. youth and the desire to live a full life shoot up violently in the young personalities. Outside the shuls, the young girls stay chattering. They walk away from the synagogue. They leave behind them the wailing of the older generation. They follow the urge for freedom and self-expression. Further and further from the shul they go. Further away to the dancing, tempting light of a fleeting joy. She says the women were abandoned. So she decided, this single girl, right, to start the Beis Yaakov movement, she was influenced by a Talmud of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, right? The great. And what did she do? In 1917, she founded the first Beis Yaakov. She approached her brother to help support her. He said it would never catch on. He took her to the Belzer Rebbe in Marienbad, who just looked at her and said, Mazel Ubracha, and she started it. When she passed away, there were 32,000 girls in the Beis Yaakov. Sarah Shanira changed the world. She saw a need, right? She didn't accept Chadash Asim and Atayra. She said, there's a need here. Let's meet it. There's a crying, yawning need. And she changed the world. She said, Yochel Nuchala, I can do it. And I think in the parsa of Shlach, each one of us has to look at the fear that's preventing us from going to our promised land and saying, Yochel Nuchala, can we? You know, on my table in Shul in the summer, there's a young fellow, Sander Gerber. An amazing thing. He was on the board of AIPAC. And he was very involved politically. And through his political connections, he discovered something amazing. In the Palestinian bylaws, the laws of the Palestinian Authority, it's written, in Shachar al-Gabi Love in black and white, if you kill a Jew, you get a stipend for the time you're in prison. If you kill two Jews, you get a three-time stipend. If you four, you get it 10 times, and the more Jews you kill, the greater is your stipend, money received in part from the American government, which supports, it gives $500 million a year or so to support the Palestinian authorities. And he was outraged. He said, in this year, 2017 money to kill Jews? And he decided, one single guy, he sits in my shul, he's a Baal Tshuva, he has the most amazing, incredible family, envious of his family, he said, I will change this. I will attempt. He started lobbying members of the Senate and of Congress, going to the office. Imagine one person is going to make a difference. And this year, something called the Taylor Force Act is going to be introduced in Congress, and there's going to be a vote that the United States will suspend all $500 million of aid if the Palestinians do not stop funding terrorism. And the reason why I say this is, I think, here is a current example. Sarah Shanira lived 100 and some odd years ago. She died around 100 in 1935, a little less than. But it's so far away from us. Here is somebody, he may daven in your shul too during the winter. And he said, I will change and I will say Yachal Nuchala. Let's go to this interview and let's be inspired by somebody who's saying, I can and I will not let obstacles, miraglim, the loy nuchals, get in my way to reach an incredible goal. Let's be inspired by this. We have on the phone with us from New York, Sander Gerber. He's the CEO of Hudson Capital. He's also the former vice chair of the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars. He's a fellow of the Jerusalem Center of Public Affairs, and he also sits at my table by davening when he summers up in Wesley Hills. Welcome, Sander.
Well, thank you, David, and a great pleasure to be here with you, and I look forward to the summer to hang out with you.
So, Sander, tell us about what you're working on, the Taylor Force Act. Most of our audience is not familiar. Give us a little bit of a synopsis of what you've done.
Well, there's a lot of people have been working on it, but there's a really sad case. Of course, all victims of Palestinian terrorism are great tragedies. In this case, there was a graduate of West Point, actually captain of the ski team there, who had served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he was walking down the boulevard between Yafo and Tel Aviv, and he was stabbed to death by a Palestinian terrorist. No one else was killed. There were other wounded. Taylor was not Jewish. The Palestinian Authority held a wedding funeral for the Shahid, the murderer that they call a martyr. And on top of that, the martyr receives payments from the Palestinian Authority. This is all pursuant to law. It's quite remarkable. It's hard to comprehend that in today's world, particularly after the Shoah, there are actually laws to kill the Jews on the books of the Palestinian Authority, and no one knew about it. The laws don't just provide payments for the murderers. They also provide job placements. If they are lucky and go to prison, they get paid while they're in prison, and when they're released from prison, if they're served for 10 years or longer in jail, they're entitled to a new job within the Palestinian Authority at a senior level. If they're in jail for 5 years or more, they're entitled to a lifetime annuity. A woman only needs 2 years for a lifetime annuity. Turns out that Taylor Force's parents are Lindsey Graham's constituents. When Lindsey Graham heard about this, he turned red. And he immediately introduced the Taylor Force Act last year with co-sponsors Dan Coats, who's now the Director of National Intelligence, and Senator Roy Blunt. It's been reintroduced this year. So far, there's only one Democrat on board, Senator Manchin from West Virginia. The other Democrats are considering it, and they seem to be in favor of joining the bill. It's obviously a bipartisan issue. The issue the Democrats have is generally that they want peace, and they're worried that the Palestinian population, if we cut off all U.S. aid, that it might harm the population. They want to preserve certain aid programs that can help the Palestinian people. Now, of course, it's very difficult to monitor these aid programs and make sure no one's skimming off the top of these programs. This is the issues that Congress is working through. I expect it will be passed. I expect it will be passed the House and the Senate. It's really a question of time. The president now has gone on a peace.
Senator, what was your involvement? How did you get involved?
Well, at the Woodrow Wilson Center, we had an event, cause of the knifing in the Palestinian in Israel, end of 15, and all the panelists were blaming Israel. And I knew something about Palestinians being paid for violence, but I thought they were paid by Hamas. I thought they were paid by Iran. I didn't realize they were actually paid by the Palestinian Authority, but when I questioned why the Wilson Center had this, and I was very disturbed, and I said to the people, the program heads, don't you know that the Palestinian, don't you know that the terrorists are paid? That's a cause of the knifing? They weren't aware. And so I decided that I had to figure it out. I had to understand, how are these people being paid and how much are they being paid? So I called up the leading translators of Arabic media, Memory and Palestinian Media Watch, Yigal Carmon and Itamar Marcus, and I said to them, how are the terrorists paid? Who pays them? And they said, oh, they're paid by the Palestinian Authority pursuant to law. So I said, get me the law. So they got me the law. And then I said, well, how much are they paid? And they said, well, there's a budget. So, well, get me the budget. So first they got me the budget.
I imagine you were astonished, right?
It was beyond belief.
It's like all hiding in plain sight.
Not hiding. Open in Arabic. Open in Arabic. The budget for the prisoners, $140 million for 2016. Specified in the budget. Prisoners are not, you know, it's not like they're maintaining jails. These are prisoners in Israeli prisons and payments to them. There are 440 full-time workers. And then I said, well, what about the budget for the martyrs? So then they looked through the budget, and, you know, it's online, actually, and they got me the budget for the martyrs, $175 million.
The martyrs being, who are the martyrs?
The martyrs are the murderers that get killed.
So there's one budget for the suicide bombers, let's say, who get blown up, and there's another budget for the people who are in jail because they plotted, and this is on the budget of the Palestinian Authority, paid from the government proceeds.
Correct.
Sort of like
and a total for 2016, it was $315 million, about 8% of their budget. That's a big percentage of the budget. I don't know what U.S. defense spending is, but I don't think it's 8% of our budget.
And nobody had really spotted it before you shined the light on it?
I think people were aware of it. I think there was a question mark within certain segments of the Israeli military that maybe the Palestinian Authority should not be challenged in any way, that it's better to tolerate 50 Jews being knifed a year than wide-scale, larger-scale attacks.
So what did you do? What was your next step? I mean, I know, Stan, to me, it's just like somebody who grew up in, like, Borough Park and Flatbush deciding that you're going to make this international event to change the law in the United States, the law in Israel, the law, it's like, I wouldn't know how to go about it. So how did you go about it?
Well, the first thing I did was I went to ask a Rav if I should insert myself in this, because there were some members of the Israeli security sector that thought that this trade-off was better, that, you know, we should give up some neshamas up front to, you know, guard against the danger of more widespread violence. And I couldn't really get a good answer to this, Shaila. So I decided that I just thought people should know about this. I thought there should be a light shined on it, so I endeavored to really put together the information in a coherent manner so that people could understand it. And I went and showed it to a lot of people. And one person in particular, General Elazar Stern in Israel, who's part of Yesh Atid, he saw it, and then he immediately introduced legislation in the Knesset, which just passed this week, to cut the Palestinian tax rebates based upon the amounts that they budget for the terror. That's actually a violation of the Paris Protocols under the Oslo Agreement, which is a very big deal for Israel to do, but they have now determined within the government conclusively that this practice is a red line. In other words, there are red lines for the Palestinian Authority, and I think that before people thought there was some kind of payments that they thought were sort of more akin to welfare payments to the terrorists. But when they realize that these payments are actually graduated, so the more you slay, the more you get paid. It's an institutionalized pay-to-slay policy where you get paid more depending upon the level of violence you incur.
The more you kill, the more
beyond,
they pay you.
Yes.
So, Sander, what would be victory for you? What would be success?
David, this is, we have to provide for secure Israel, and success would be the Palestinian Authority teaching their people that peace with Israel is in everyone's interest.
That's not going to happen. What would be legislative success for you,
David? You're a Democrat. Come on, you got to believe in this.
What do you want to accomplish? You would like to have the Taylor Force Act, which was introduced.
Obviously, the most important thing that your listeners can do is to call Senator Schumer, who understands the importance of this, and say, given the history of the Jewish people and the Shoah, it's intolerable to have laws to kill the Jews anywhere in the world. And what's especially an affront to the American taxpayer is that we're not just looking the other way, we're actually funding them. We are directly funding Palestinian terror. And if they could call Senator Schumer, who is really a linchpin for this, and ask him to sign on as quickly as he can, and I think he's amenable to it, but he needs people to tell him they care. And if he hears from enough people that they care, I think it can make a difference.
And if the Taylor Force Act passes, in effect, it would suspend all support of Palestinian Authority as long as they continue to pay stipends for martyrs and murderers of Jewish people.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, Sander, it's an
amazing... That's a high bar to ask for.
Sander, it's astonishing that a simple Yidula has gotten it this far. You've brought it to this, and I've seen it in all types of international press. And let's, you know, anything we could do, let's try to push this over to, you know, over the finish line, right?
Well, one place that people can go to for more information is stopmoneyformurder.com, stopmoneyformurder.com. It's, it was actually created by the Christians United for Israel, who immediately understood the significance of this. And now there are many Jewish groups involved. The OU was the first to sign on with the Republican Jewish Coalition. The Aguda has now signed on, the World Jewish Congress. It's, the Conference of Presidents came out in favor of it. But, you know, a lot of people still don't know what's going on. So if you go to Stop Money for Murder, you can see the actual legislation is on that website. And I think making people aware of the true narrative of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians would be very helpful to move us towards a resolution.
Thank you very much, Sandra, for discussing this with us. Nice speaking to you. Each one of us can take a lesson. We are in our lives. Can we learn from these two people and say, Yochel Nuchel, we can. We will not be afraid. We were brought here for a destiny, for a reason. We can. Let's go to the phones to speak to our fabulous guest. We have on the phone with us from Lakewood, New Jersey, Rabbi Yisrael Barkin, who's the co-author of a sefer called Levush Ha'arin, and it is on Tcheles, our topic du jour. Welcome, Rabbi Barkin.
Assalamu alaikum.
Rabbi Barkin, could you give us the 5, 6, 7, 8, what you would believe are the most powerful rayas that the Tcheles from the Murex snail is indeed the correct Tcheles?
So, let's say we start with Bavli. If you start off in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Chav Vav Amud Aleph, it speaks about Nebuzradon, the general of Nebuchadnezzar who came to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, that he left people after the Golos, he left people in Eretz Yisrael to catch Chivazims in order to get them for the royal wardrobe of Nebuchadnezzar. And it says that he left those people to catch the Chivazim in the northern parts of Eretz Yisrael, between Tzor, which is Tyre, and Haifa. So you see from there that the Chivazim was something that was used for royal garments, as Rashi over there says, and it was something that was especially caught in the northern part of Eretz Yisrael, which is exactly the case with the Murex snail, which is caught in the northern parts of Eretz Yisrael, especially. Other places also, but it's that's a special place for catching it. It's more concentrated there. That's historically where it was caught. And it was used for royal clothing. Number two is later on in Masechet Shabbos, where the Gemara speaks about the Malachas and where he learned them out from. There's on the Ayin Dalet and Ayin Hey. There's two sugyas about the Chilazim. So there's one Gemara about catching the Chilazim. And it says there that you catch them with nets, which is the way that you would catch. We really should have stepped back. I think we'll get to that later, that the word chilazin means snail. That's just a translation, dictionary translation of chilazin. We'll speak about that after, I guess, after the Gemaras. But if you go with that assumption, which I'll prove, I guess, in a few minutes. So the Gemara says about catching the chilazin, and Rashi says you catch it with nets. That's what you do with this Murex snail. You don't usually catch snails with nets. But the Murex snail, the way it eats is that it smells out meat, any meat, dead fish, that, you know, you have them in a fish tank, you feed them pieces of chicken or meat, or eat other even living snails, it will attack. So if you would put out a net, a flat net in the ocean and the seabed, then they'll come up over there, and they'll walk up onto that net, and they'll come to that meat, they'll congregate over there on top of the net, then you lift the net, and that will be a chiyuv tzedah. The Gemara says later on the fine hay, how it's a chiyuv tzedah, because it's taught chilazim to catch a snail on Shabbos, even though it's slow moving, but you're catching something from deep in the ocean. There's a lot of work going into it, so it's for sure a chiyuv tzedah. That's a separate discussion in itself. I don't know if we're going to get to that, but that gemara is something that fits perfectly with the murex, the way that you're using nets to catch it. And there's going to be a chiyuv tzedah because of that. That's number two, I guess.
Okay, continue number three.
So we have number three. It says the gemara speaks there and that I inhale it out in Shabbos. It speaks about breaking open the chilazin and which malachas you're over on. It says that there's a malacha of dosh, which is like extracting wheat from the shell. That's where one of the cases of the chiv of dosh. It says that in the Mishkan, they did dosh when they cracked open the chilazin. So this Burek's nail also, you don't just squeeze out the blood, it's cracked open. The Rav Amram and Rambam discusses the cracking of chilazim to be like smashing it open, like smashing nuts.
So I believe the Lashon of Rashi on in Shabbos, on Daf Chavav, Rashi says, Paitzin es hachalazin. Paitzin means like, to crack it like you would a nut.
Yes, let me clarify something. That's a Rav Amram and Rambam that says it's like a nut. There are those that ask a kasha. They say that Rashi says patir chilazin. Look again at that Rashi.
Sh'aitzrin upaitzin es hachalazin l'haitzi damai.
Can I read it with Paraklau Gadol?
Yes, correct.
Okay, but there's another Rashi in that Ayin Hei Amid Aleph that says patir chilazin. Rashi says doich kai biyodai k'deshi yete damai. That you squeeze it with your hand. So
right.
I quote your Rav Amram and Rambam that's like smashing like a nut, and that's good with the Murex. Rashi, first glance, someone doesn't think too deeply, would think that this Rashi is against the Murex. And you'll see sometimes in like anti-Murex publications, they make it like a big kasha. They discovered America, they found that this Rashi is against the Murex. Really, it's not true. There's two reasons why it's not true. But I'll give one reason is that, first, the Igli Talaray discussed this Rashi, and he has a long discussion, which I don't think it's time to get right into right now, but basically the great Tal says that cracking the shell, you're cracking the shell in order to get to the worm that's inside after you break the worm open to get the blood out. So he says that Rashi holds that breaking the shell is not a melacha of dosh. He has a reason why not, because that's the first shell. You still have to do another stage of breaking, according to Rashi. So that's why Rashi only speaks about smashing the inside, the worm that's inside. So if you want to focus on Rashi, that's a more accurate description of Rashi. And Rashi also fits with the Murex's snail. Number four is that there's a whole discussion in the Gemara. The Gemara goes on more lengthy over there later on in the Ayin Hei Amid Aleph. It speaks about the melach of killing the chilazin when you break it open. So it says this whole thing that when you smash it, it's for sure going to die. It's a psikresha that's going to die. And it says that you don't want it to die, even though it's going to die, it's not something you want it to happen. You would rather it stay alive as much as possible because the dye content, the ink that's in it, is going to be less quality if the chilazin dies faster before you extract it. So that's also something that's a complete correlation with the Murex, because the Murex is something that people that deal with it now see that, and it's documented in ancient writings of those that dealt with it. People that dealt with it 2,000 years ago and wrote books about it also, that it's something that you want it to stay alive. It's not good if the chilazin dies before you extract the blood.
It degrades the quality of the dye if it's not done immediately. That's done before.
Into the snail. The dye could, besides for degrading the quality, it soaks into the snail, into the meat of the snail itself, and becomes lesser quality like that. You have to re-extract
okay.
it, and it gets degraded like that.
What's Raya number five?
Number five is, if we move out of Masech Shabbos into Masech Megillah, you see also over there, Shevet Zvulun. There's a special connection between the Chilazin and Shevet Zvulun. So, it says that Shevet Zvulun had a special bracha for the Chilazin. There's different ways to learn that Gemara. I'll start off with the way Rabbi Yaakov Emden learns that Gemara. He says that Shevet Zvulun had a tremendous... He says that Shevet Zvulun had a big space, had a big area, real estate, along the northern coast of Eretz Yisrael, and that's where the Murex is found. Rabbi Yaakov Emden almost points directly to the Murex. He doesn't call it by name over there. But he says that the Gemara Megillah speaks about Shevet Zvulun, and he said Zvulun had a nachla over there, and that's where this same snail, which is lengthily described in any ancient writings, in the Kaisvei Divrei Yomim, he says, I think, that they describe such a snail that he doesn't use the word snail there either. But he says they describe this, this bria.
Well, isn't it, Rabbi Barkin, isn't it Rashi? It says, in the Berchas Moshe, it says, by Zvulun, Berchas Zvulun, it says, Usfune Tzmune Chayel, that hides in the sand. And the I think it's either Rashi, one of the Mepharshim says that refers to the Chalazin, Rashi on the spot. So it's obviously some creature that hides in the sand, which is exactly what this snail does, and it's on the shore, which is between Tyre and Haifa, along Zvulun.
I get to hiding in the sand. Hiding in the sand was my next, after we finish the Gemara, and we go through Midrashim, I'm going to tell
okay.
you more about hiding in the sand, so let's just put that off for a second. Once
okay.
you mentioned Rashi, there's Rashi also says by Yaakov Avinu's Brachis, L'choiz Yamim Yishkain, Rashi says that's where his Nachla is. So Rashi seems, and there's a Tosis Rid in Bar Basra, also is pretty clear, and a lot of Mepharshim, the Radak in the Chumash, there's a little bit of Radak in Sefer Bereishis. It's not such a well-known Sefer. They seem to hold that Shevet Zvulun had a big chelek along the coast. They have a way to learn that up in Sefer Yeshua. The Pesukim Sefer Yeshua are not very clear about where the Gvul is, but a lot of these Mepharshim hold like that. The Kaftar Farach holds like that also, that Shevet Zvulun had a tremendous space along the ocean. Like we're saying, that it's something that lives. You mentioned it hides in the sand. You know, we'll get to that soon. Now, there's another way to learn that Gemara also, because there's another school of thought, other Mepharshim, that seem to say that Zvulun only had a very small place by the ocean, not a big place like these Mepharshim. And they also have their rayas from Navi. Both Mepharshim have rayas. It's old Mechoikas Kedoyla Mepharshim. I wrote a whole article about it, a lot of Marmakaimus about it. Sometimes you have people speaking about it like there's only one Mahalach, and the way I learn Navi is that Mahalach, but really,
okay.
There's a big...
What's the next Raya? So we have Sude Tzmune Chayel, we have the Rashi Bezvul,
right.
And what's the next Raya?
I was just going to finish up, just to quickly just touch up this Raya, that according to the Tzad, that Zvulun did not have a big space by the shore. So Zvulun, with his little space by the shore, that was a space that was good for docking boats. That's what the Brach of Yaakov was, that he would get a good place, even a small place, that's good for docking boats. And with docking boats, you go out with the boats and catch the chilas and catch the murechs, because the murechs, even though it's near the shore, but the ones right by the shore will get depleted pretty quick. And you can go out with boats to catch the ones that are deeper out. You go out with boats, like I said before, that you have nets, to drop nets, so you need to go out with boats in order to drop those nets into the ocean. And that's...
Rabbi Barak, what's the next raya?
Sure. Okay, so if you go on to Bom Mitzia, that's Samach Aleph on the base, the Gemara there says, a kvala that Hashem is going to punish someone who puts kla ilon in his baguette and says it's tchelas. Kla ilon, the Rishonim says indigo. So it means there's a punishment if someone puts indigo in his clothing and says that that's tchelas. So he's faking. He's using something that's not really good for a mitzvah. If someone puts kla ilon in his baguette, it means that the guy is really doing a good job fooling, because kla ilon looks exactly like tchelas. There's other rayas from the Gemara also that kla ilon looks exactly like. There's no way to tell the difference. The Gemara says you have to do special chemical tests to know the difference. So kla'ilon is indigo, and this murex makes a color that's exactly the same color as the indigo.
Right, it's basically blue jeans. Indigo is what's used to color blue jeans, and tchelas is the same color as basically
same
blue
color.
Jeans.
I've seen a piece of indigo dyed wool, and I looked at it very, very for a long time next to a piece of tchelas from the murex. It's the same exact color.
Yeah. The Gemara also seems to imply that there is nothing else except for indigo that is the exact same color.
Yeah.
So when we find the snail and we say it's the exact color as indigo, the Gemara seems to imply that there is nothing else in the world that is the same exact color as indigo except for the chilazain.
Yeah, that's definitely the impression you get from learning the Gemara. That's for sure the Ashkafri, so you know there's rayas to that also.
From the Gemara Menachos too.
Yeah,
so,
I have to say Ashtukal Torah to be Mechadish now like that.
So being that we found something that's the exact same color as indigo, you would have to say that there's another Bria that the Gemara did not know about, that also, by the way, lives off the shore of Israel, off the thing of Spain, hides in the sand, go through all your eyes, and the Gemara did not know about it, and that's also the same color of indigo.
Right, one Pasha and one Pasha, and there's no mention of the Gemara. It's a very tremendous amtar that you have to be mechadesh to be...
What's the next Raya?
Okay, next Raya is from... There's a Gemara in Yevamos also that speaks about tchelas, that it goes onto wool, and it says that it's not kosher if you put tchelas onto linen. Now, the Gemara is not clear. It's clear in the Gemara that tchelas would be able to go onto linen just as possible, but I'm just going to jump over to the Sefer HaChinuch that he seems to understand from that Gemara. It's not really clear in that Gemara, but the Sefer HaChinuch seems to understand from there that even though tchelas goes into linen, it doesn't work as good in linen. The dye doesn't come out as good. So that's something also they have in the Murex dye. That's not the strongest raya in the world, because there's a lot of other dyes also that work better in wool than linen. But there is a correlation, you know, M calls that. It's
okay.
That the murex thing that goes into wool, it goes into linen, but it works better in wool than in linen. Those are the facts.
Okay.
It was tried and tested. It works in linen, but doesn't work as good. You know, before the experiments were made, there were different rumors about it. But
okay, what's your next raya?
When you go to Sanhedrin, the Gemara speaks about Chilodin on the mountain, on a rainy day. So over there, there's actually a machlokes. Rashi says it's about the chilazon of tchilas that climbs up onto the mountain on a rainy day and lays eggs over there. So that's actually something that you don't have in the Murex. No one saw it climbing up onto the mountain. So, you know, some people use that Rashi as a question on the Murex. You know, but really you have to look at another Rishonim in the Yad Ramah, and there's Rayas from a lot of other Rishonim, there's Rayas from the Oroch, and there's Rayas from Tosis and the Ritva. It's you know, it's a big discussion. I don't think the whole in-depth discussion is for now. But most Rishonim understand that Gemara is talking about the general species of snails, that they come up on a rainy day. When it's a rainy day on the mountain, then snails appear. So from that Gemara, you see the idea that chilazon, the English translation word for chilazon is snails, which is something I'm going to get to later. So that's another raya.
In other words, basically the raya is that the chilazon seems to be both a shore and not a shore, that man. And okay. There's not a lot of different types of brias. There are not that many creatures that have one part of the family lives ashore and one part of it doesn't live ashore.
And the ones that live ashore are the ones that appear in rainy days.
And the snail is one of those creatures which there's, you know, anybody who's had a tomato garden knows that the snails come and are eating up all your plants. And the same thing, there are snails and shells that live in the water as well. So the Gemara refers to chilazon, that type of creature. The chilazon comes from a min that is clearly a snail. It lives both on the shore and off the shore.
Yeah.
Okay, that's your next try. What's the next?
The min, I'll jump to Masechta Avodah Zarah, where the Gemara speaks about a kind of refuah for a certain sickness, and it says that you use some kind of chilazon, meshakti chilazoni. So over there also, the way Rashi explained it in Elah's word, is that it's a limtza, which is very evident from many places in Rashi, that it's a snail. Rashi,
old French.
Yeah. Rashi says min chilazon. It's a type of, Rashi means to say there, min chilazon.
Okay. What's your next raya?
All kinds of snails, like I'm saying. So over there is also a type of snail, just like the Gemara in Sanhedrin, according to most Rishonim. Of course, not like Rashi in Sanhedrin, but we're naturally following.
What is your next raya, Rabbi Barkin?
Yeah. So in Menachos and of Mem Dal Malaf, there's a short description of what the chilazon looks like. So if you look at that braisa and you examine it properly, then it's a very clear description of the murex. Sometimes people think that it doesn't fit so well with the murex, that braisa. It's only because of people didn't examine the braisa and understand it in context properly.
It's daima l'yam. So we say the Gemara.
Yeah, it says Tanur Abanon, chilazon ze gufay daima l'yam. Ubiyasa daimil adag, va'ayla achas l'shivim shana, ubidama yitzayvim tcheles, l'sikach dama v'yakarim. So there are about five phrases there, if I counted right. First thing is chilazon zeh, this chilazon. So chilazon is something that I hope we'll get to later, is something that could be clearly proven that the dictionary translation of chilazon means snail. Even if it means other similar species to snails, but it for sure includes snail. Gufay daimil yam. Then it gives two descriptions of the chilazon, you know, of the chilazon itself. The rest of it is like things that it does. The two descriptions the Brisa gives of the chilazon itself is that its body is similar to the sea, and its briyase, which means its form, Rashi says there, tavnis diokonai. Tavnis diokonai is like tavnis kalash or b'mayim, you know, tavnis is a shape, so its shape, its look, tavnis diokonai, its shape is like a fish. So Gufa demliam means that its body looks like the ocean, which is what you see in the Murex. Anyone who went diving for the Murex, there's places I've been there in Eretz Yisrael, you could go catch them fresh.
They're very hard to see. They blend into the water.
Exactly. They blend into the water, the yam. The yam is a seabed.
Good camouflage.
The word yam means a seabed. The Ramban says that. The
right.
First time the Torah uses the word yam, you can look in the Ramban there. And it's one of the first took him. The Ramban says that the Iker word yam means seabed. Every time yam means the water of the sea, it's always a borrowed term. So it looks like the seabed, it camouflages in. This camouflage is a real part of the life of the chilazon, the camouflage stuff that goes in. You can't get it off. I once went to Eretz Yisrael, I caught a chilazon. I went to the group that caught a chilazon, actually, I didn't do it myself. And I went and tried to brush off the stuff with a brush with metal bristles. You know, it reminded me of the Masrekos for Barazol, you know. And I rub. It doesn't come off. The coating doesn't come off. All you do is that you take off the outer coating, and the inner coating is still there. The inner coating doesn't come off. The inner coating is greenish, aquamarine, turquoise-ish. So, you know, this cover, besides blending into the seabed, it also has it has many times this greenish shade, which also looks like the top of the yam, which the yam is blue-green. So in Daimu Liam, the two meanings of Daimu Liam, the seabed and the sea, they both happen with the murex.
What does it mean, Gufay Daimu Ladag?
So it says Briyasa Daimu Ladag. Gufay Daimu Liam, Briyasa Daimu Ladag. Briyasa, Rashi says, that means the shape is like a fish, which is an extremely obvious thing that you could see. Many people notice this right away, kids, old people, men, women, Rabbonim, simple people, is that the shape of the murex snail. If you just put the snail down in the table, it looks like a fish. It looks like a regular fish.
Okay.
The fact that
it says...
I'll just say one more thing. The fact that it's the Briyasa Daimu Ladag means that it's not a simple fish like every regular fish that swims around. It's something else.
Daimu Ladag, it's similar
creature,
to a dog.
Yeah. But it can be a dog also because it's a sea creature. But Daimu Ladag means more like a specific type of dog, which...
Okay, let's continue,
Okay, then it says, So it says, so we have to look at Rashi there, and it's clear from Rashi and many other places also, that when it says, it's giving a description of why it's expensive. It's not coming there to describe to you how to find the chilos or something like that. Which is a whole right that this bryce is trying to like show you certain things about the chilos. It's not a search guide to help you find it. There are those that learn this bryce as a search guide. If someone wants to find the chilos, just use it as a search guide. It's not a search guide. It's telling you certain things that you have to know about it.
Okay, continue.
So that's the reason why it's expensive is another thing that you have to know about is because it comes once in every 70 years. Comes up once every 70 years means that it's something that's caught in the ocean. Once every 70 years is a figurative way of saying once in a lifetime. There's many rayas from Chazal that Shivim Shana is used in Chazal's terminology as once in a lifetime, because Shivim Shana is an example of a lifetime, right? You mentioned Seinu.
It's expensive and hard to get a hold of. That's the bottom line.
Right. So it's
and it is very expensive till today. I understand, right?
But for different, it's not nearly as expensive as it used to be. I'm going to tell you why. Because the reason why it used to be expensive is because it was deep in the ocean. Oilach Shemshana means that it's only once in a lifetime thing that would come up in a freak accident, in a hurricane or something. But the normal way of catching it would be to go down into the ocean, like Rashi said, that you go out in boats and lay nets. So that's a very expensive thing to do in those days without any modern equipment. And these boats could flip over, people could die from it. It's documented about this, that people were going to the Great Sakana, catching the murex in those days. So in those days, it would be 10 times more expensive than these days. These days, you could buy a Sayos Chelos for $70, $80, $90, $60 even. In those days, it would be much, much more expensive. It was compared to gold, or more expensive than gold. All because of this, because the great effort and danger of going down to the ocean, because it only comes up once in a lifetime. That's exactly what Eilach Shivim Shana means, and how Rashi explains it, that it's the reason why it's expensive. And then the last thing the Brisa says is Vedomu Shivim Treilus, which is very straightforward. It's something that you color a treilus with it, which is exactly what the murex does. The murex is something that colors treilus with it. There's no other sea creature in the world that could color a treilus, and even more, there's no sea creature in the world that was used the chal for any kind of color. It's only the murex family, that is used for color, and it can be made treilus out of. So that's the brisa in a nutshell. And it's
okay, what are your next rayas? Bring a few more.
Yeah.
Give us, Rabbi Barkin, how many more rayas do you have?
I would go to, a little bit to Yerushalmi and Midrashim now, if there's time. I would go to one famous medrash, just to prove that the word chilazin means a snail, because the medrash describes the clothing.
Natika gadolimai.
Natika gadolimai. It says just like a chilazin has an artika gadolimai, also their clothing grew with them. So chilazin there is a regular word of something that's well known, a snail, which its clothes grow with it. There's a chorinim that speak this out. The Divrei Yosef says that you see from this medrash that means a snail.
You're saying this is the medrash in Shir HaShirim,
Perek
Dalet. Seyu lamad menachalazin shekolzman shu gadol nartikai gadol imai.
Nartikai gadol imai, right. It's quoted in Midrashim, and the Rosh brings the medrash beisa gadol imai, its house grows with it, or other places.
So if you say nartikai gadol imai, beisa gadol imai, it has to be a snail, right?
Yeah, it could be a turtle also, but it can't be a turtle because five Rishonim say the Chilazin is a Tilas. I could get that later. There's five Rishonim that say clear describe the Tilas as a worm. So if you put together a worm with something that the shell grows with it, then you're left with a snail. linguistically also, it's known Arabic word. It's the Middle Eastern languages. There's a modern language, Syriac, that's almost a duplicate of the Aramaic and the Gemara. And this Chazuna means snail there.
Okay, continue. Give it.
Snails, but
Rabbi Barkin, how many more rayas do you have?
I'm going to quote you another medrash about Suni Timunei Chol you mentioned before, that buried in the ochean. So there's a medrash, Lekach Toiv, that is from the Rishonim, I think he's quoting Midrashim, that he makes it so clear, so vividly the way he describes it. He says, Suni Timunei Chol, Zach Ilazim, Shasafun Vitamin Bechor. He uses two Rishonim. It's totally hidden in the ocean. The murex is something, not only it goes
in
a little
sand,
bit...
In the sand.
And right. The murex, it goes totally in. My friend has a fish tank with live chilazin in liquid. I bought it from Eretz Yisrael once, and it's still alive. And he lost the chilazin. He didn't know where it was. And he emptied out his whole thing. Finally, he realized it buried itself totally into the sand. It buried itself.
Wow.
It's exactly.
Okay.
There's another medrash that Rishonim quote, that they say that Yaakov Avinu sent to Yosef, you know, when they didn't know who he was yet, they said, Chumi Zimr Sa'aret, bring the things that, they bring the very
light, Shkedim, etc., yeah.
So, about the Shkedim, right? So Zimr Sa'aret, the Major says, is the Chilazin. You see also that the Chilazin was like a well-known, important thing in the world in those days, which is exactly the Murex, which was a well-known, important thing in those days. But the Rishonim bring a alternative, a variable, Nusach of the Medrash that adds another few words. It says, Chilazin is Tzoyvim Mimenu Kametzvah. It's a Chilazin that you can make many colors out of it, which is exactly the Murex. Everyone knows that reads about the Murex knows that it doesn't just make blue. It makes blue, it makes purple, it can make reddish, violet. So, of course, Tzoyvim is blue, and you use the blue from it, which is very simple to make blue from it. But it's something that can make many colors out of it, and that's the way the Medrash describes it. Chilazin is Tzoyvim Mimenu Kametzvah.
Hmm. Okay, continue.
So that's in a nutshell the riots like that I would bring up from Chazal. It's all one more thing I forgot. There's Yerushalmi that has a discussion about if he wasn't has Gidim about Thomas, if it has bones and tendons, sinews or not. So it has a whole discussion: does it have and doesn't, or does not have bones? And then there's a child in the Farshim how to learn the Maskana of the Yerushalmi. There's a riot from the Ramban that the Maskana of the Yerushalmi that it does have bones. What's the whole question? Everyone knows what a chilazin is in the time of the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi is having a discussion, does it have bones or does it not have bones? Take a look. You know, it tries to prove different rayas, like from the length of its lifespan, if it has bones. When the chilazin is a snail, then it's extremely possible what it means, because a snail doesn't have bones, but it has a big, huge bone outside of it. It has this shell. So the question is this considered a bone or not? It has also, like, small gidim. You could see pictures of them. It has, but not the regular heavy gidim that you have in a cow that you use to sell your tefillin, you know. So that's exactly why the Yerushalmi has a whole discussion. Does it have bones or does it not have bones? Does it have gidim or does it not have gidim? Because it's a snail, and the snail, you have to know how to describe it. Is this outer shell considered a bone of it or not?
Okay, tell us what other rayas. Give us your next three, not Chazal rayas. Give us three more rayas, because we'll be on... I think you have 100 rayas. Let's do the next three, and give us your three best rayas.
Not Chazal rayas is that that just like historically, this was just such a well-known thing that was used in ancient days, and it's documented in, you know, outside books also. Is Aristotle, is other books that document things. Because to document things I mentioned before, Back of Endon refers to these books, and they talk about this royal color that was so coveted. And you know, all the colors they mentioned also, like I said, there's all different colors you can make from it, and it was something that the Roman emperors made a xero against it. And this it's the only thing that they mentioned to be a color that comes from the ocean, a coloring thing that comes from the ocean. So that fits very good with the chilazin, which you find in Chazal and in Tukim also, which was a well-known thing, and something that kings used, Achashverus, he would go with Tcheras. You know, it says that what's his name? It says, and I quoted before, Rashi says about Nebuchadnezzar wanting Tcheras, it says about Chirum al Tzar and Tukim in Yechezkel, it's Tukim in Yirmiya, it's Tukim all over, that Tcheras was such a big, important thing known in the world, and that's something that you find in all these books. It's archaeologically found. Piles and piles, millions of those shells are found in the exact same place, you know, in the Tsar and the Phoenician kingdom, the ancient Phoenician kingdom, And that's what you find in the Gemara, that he was chivazin to me, so was it tzar v'alchefa. Kaftar v'farach in that Gemara says it's talking about chivazin of tcheles.
Okay, what other rayas do you have?
So you could prove also, you could support, at least, you know, some of these rayas aren't self-proving by themselves, but another support comes in. If you look historically at the timeline, when chivazin use and tcheles use went away from us. So if you look at, it was well used in time of the Beis HaMikdash, obviously they made big kuna from it. In time of the Gemara, you see that there's different Gemaras, you see that it says that they didn't use it that much because there's Gemaras that they only brought it in from some other place at a certain time later on. In time of the Rishonim, they didn't have tcheles at all, and it was lost right from time of the Gaonim. The Ramban says, the Moshe Gaonim, they didn't have tcheles. So what happened over there? That from time of the Beis HaMikdash they had it, and right after the Beis HaMikdash in time of Tanaim, I didn't tell you yet. So in time of Tanaim, did they have it or not? So there's a raya from the Sifri. The Sifri says in the time of Rabbi Yossi, who was like 50, 80 years after the Korban, it says that that it was found a little bit. There was a Zalkin that was able to catch it, but he said that it was Gonos, it was Nignas. So it was hard to get it, but he was getting it. So what happened to Sifri? He was getting it. He wasn't getting it at the same time. That's all because of the gzeiras of the Romans, because this is documented also in Roman archives, which are accessible these days, that emperors, starting from the time of the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and made progressively stronger gzeiras, which went stronger and stronger until the time of the end of the time of the Gemara, and time of the Goyim was all over, that their grip became stronger and stronger on Eretz Yisrael. And that's why the Talmud Yerushalmi was Nechtam earlier also. And that's why the Kiddush HaChodesh stopped then also in the middle of the time of the Gemara. It's all because of what the Romans, Xeris and Eretz Yisrael, where they called the Tcheles. So two things happened. First of all, the Roman Xeris became stronger and stronger from the time of the Churban and on. And also, their control over Eretz Yisrael and their Redifus got worse and worse, exactly until the middle and end time of the Talmud Bavli era. And that's exactly where you see the tcheles disappearing. The tcheles has totally disappeared by the time of the Goyim. The Ramban says in time of the Goyim, there's no more tcheles. In time of the Gemara, you see it being hard. In time of the Tanaim, you see it being hard. I would throw in something, that this is a very good pshat in Arizal. Arizal says there's only tcheles in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. You know, some people come to you saying, how can you wear tcheles? Arizal says only in time of the Beis HaMikdash. So, I'm after Beis HaMikdash also. So what's Arizal saying? You have to understand Arizal before you ask questions. Sometimes people like to ask questions without knowing what they're asking from. But you have to understand Arizal. Now, with the Metzius of the Murex, Arizal is very understood, because it was just exactly at that time in the Beis HaMikdash, that was documented in Roman records. It was just that time when the Gzeiras started, and they got worse and worse. So in time of Beis HaMikdash, there was always Tcheles. After time of the Korban, then it became more and more limited. It wasn't always available. That's why the Rizal says it's only in time of the Beis HaMikdash.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you say that historically they say off the shore of Haifa they found mounds of the Murex that's like, they say, 100 meters long and 50, basically the size of a football field, 3 or 4 meters deep, 10 feet deep, all split in the exact place to take out the blue gland. And so obviously over hundreds or maybe thousands of years in that exact area, by the Chilke of Zvulun, in the ocean, in the Chil, they found that, which were obviously mined there by prior generations. Would that be something that you would think is a raya?
It helps you build up the case to understand the Messiah. That itself, you know, just finding these cells, not a raya, doesn't say this is tcheles, but when you understand the historical background of the chashivas of the snail, then it builds up the case tremendously, because you have to look at everything in perspective.
Now, what do you say to this? You didn't mention something, or maybe it's not a chazal or anything, but that they have found in Masada tcheles, and they did a DNA test on it. You could Google this, and it's the DNA shows that it comes from the Murex snail, which means around 2,000 years ago, or that's basically the Zman when Masada was destroyed right after the Churban, The tchelis they used then was clearly from the murex snail in Masada. Now, Rabbi Bleich, when I mentioned this to him, he said, well, the people in Masada weren't necessarily, you know, the same religious that we were. So you would have to say that as part, I mean, all the Sifrei Torah, the chalakim of the Sifrei Torah they found in Masada are identical to what we have. So
yeah,
you would say that...
Can I clear something up right now?
Yes.
The thing in Masada was not tchelis on tzitzis at all. I did not bring that for a support.
No, it was not tzitzis, but they were using the color tchelis.
To show that it was used. It was a slightly violent.
So we would have to have, we would say that they used that tchelis and the murex.
It was used in the world in that time. We knew that without Masada.
And it was used on clothing in Hebrew, in Israel. So you would have to say that there must be a different color, the exact same thing, which is Neged Gemara in Menachos, that was punk being used in Masada, but that is not the genuine chalas.
The point is that
a startling coincidence.
The point is that all these colors were being used in Eretz Yisrael at the same time, and they were being dyed in the same place. And in Chazal, you just find down the word chilazin, which just means snail, and snail used for chalas. The Tosafta says, how do you make chalas? Min chilazin. How do you not make chalas? What's bad chalas? Shloim min chilazin. It's not from chilazin.
So Rabbi Barkin...
How religious they were. So the point is just that this thing was used.
Was what they used.
There was another thing found in a different archaeological place in the Qumran caves, and that thing is more bluish. The one in Masada happens to be slightly violet. It's not a pure blue. There was the New York Times published it, and they doctored up the colors. It's slightly violet, which also shows that it was used, but it's not a pure blue. There was later they published, it was discovered earlier, something from sea caves, there's no remnants of violet at all. It's greenish bluish. So either way, the snail is for sure used.
So do you have any other Rabbi Barkin in closing? Could you give us any other rias?
That was the basic thing. I can't think offhand. There's much more to say. Nothing's coming to me right this second. But
archaeologically, biologically, and its comparison. Well, can I ask you a question?
More correlation with the Rishonim, if you want to hear quotes from the Rishonim, that things that the Rishonim say, that the Utchilazim.
Which is what? There.
But, if we were to go through the whole, corpus of Rishonim writings and how it fits with Utchilazim, that could be a whole separate discussion. But there's some things that are really striking.
Like, for example, give us one.
Taisus says, Rabbein Utam said that the blood of Utchilazim is the Mitkad pocket. It's enclosed thing in itself. It stays by itself. It's not the lifeblood. And that's what you have with the murex. It's a special dye pouch. It's not part of the lifeblood of the chilazin. You have Rishonim, five Rishonim that call it the Tilas. You have Rashi, the Rash Mishans, the Raivir, the Rav Yoh, from Nosnavi Yeshiva, five Rishonim that call it what a snail is. A snail has a worm inside it. You can open up the murex and see the worm that's hiding inside it. You have Rishonim that say... You have Rishonim that says that Rashi that speaks about how it was a royal thing that the Nebuchadnezzar would have wanted. You have a Rashi that gives a Laz word for the word chilazin I mentioned before, limsa, which is very clear from Rashi uses that word many times, and Rashi clearly uses that word as an old French word for a snail.
So Rabbi Barkin, do you wear tchelas?
Yes.
Yeah, so do I. And which ones do you wear? Do you wear... the two string, the one string like the Rambam, the two string or the four string, which is Taisvis?
Well, I do like the psak of my uncle Rabelski Zatzal that he did by himself, and that's how he always asking for all his Talmidim and anyone who asked him to do like...
Which is what?
Taisvis, which is two strings, that's what it says in Mishnah Berurah.
Two strings doubled over, which is four strings.
Doubled over, which is four.
Yeah, that's how the Mishnah Berurah brings it, yeah.
About 25 reciting them that say like that, or more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, there's some other opinions around also, but that's
yeah.
Mainstream in the Paiskim to go with that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for clarifying this and for all the work you've done on behalf of being Megala the Mitzvah of Tchelos.
Okay, thank you.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone Hagoyin Rav Yehuda David Bleich, who's the Marad Astra of Kehilas Beis Yehuda, B'nai Yehuda. He's also Rosh Yeshiva by Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. He's a musmach by the Rashke Bahagra Moshe Feinstein, and he's one of the few people in the world who could say that Rav Moshe referred to them as Yedidi. It's an honor to have you with us, Rabbi Bleich.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Rav Bleich, I learned the sugya of Tcheles. We get a lot of people who are interested in it. And it seems that there are so many compelling rayas, both from psukim, from chazal, from history, from archaeology, etc., now DNA testing. It seems like, it's an avera. It's a bitul asei biyadayim not to wear it. And in particular because, most paiskim them on that wearing, even though it says halovan ainam akavis atchelos, but chelos ainam akavis halovan, it's like tefillin shel yad is not makiv shel reish, but you still, who would just pay shel reish and not wear shel yad? So why don't we, aren't we makbid to wear the new chelos? If we could be makayim a mitzvah that for well over 1,000 years was lost, we spend so much time looking for the lulav and the esrig that it's one day you makayim a deraisa. Here a person could be makayim 12 hours a day, some days 15 hours, 365 days a year, such a beautiful mitzvah. The Torah says it's shakal keneged kala Torah kulat as a chazal. Why aren't we do it kirei?
We absolutely should if we knew what the tchelos was. The only response is, number one, well, first of all, the caveat. I'm certainly not an expert in tchelos. I have read the literature, particularly the scientific literature with regard to the so-called royal purple. But at the end of the day, the response to your question is really a very simple one. And it's the same response that was given when there was much less scientific evidence that could be brought to bear, but nothing has really changed. And that's the response of the Beis Halevi. The response of the Beis Halevi is that without a Masorah, without a valid tradition from generation to generation, we don't know very much of anything. The wearing, I don't want to be emphatic or overly strong in my language, but the acceptance of the so-called scientific evidence, and I'll try to explain in a moment, there's really no scientific evidence, but the so-called scientific evidence is not confirmed in any way by our Masorah. We don't have a tradition. There are many things that we couldn't possibly know without a Masorah. There's no way to be mekayim any mitzvah, to fulfill mitzvah, unless you understand the parameters of the mitzvah, and that involves understanding precisely what it is that the Torah is commanding. I haven't seen it any place, but we have a pasuk, Shal avicho v'yagedecho zekeinecho v'yemruloch. Zekeinecho v'yemruloch, I understand. Zokin zeshekon chochmo. You have to ask the Chachomim of the generation if you have any question halacha. The Imraloch, they'll tell you what halacha is. The Shal Avicho V'Yagedcho seems to be superfluous. What is there to ask the father? You want no halacha, ask the Rav, ask the Chacham. What's the Shal Avicho? And I think the answer is really simple. Before you deal with Shalos of halacha, you have to know what it is that you're talking about. And what it is that you're talking about doesn't involve halacha. It involves empirical reality. And we don't know the world, the reality of the world, as it relates to mitzvahs without a Masorah. The father is the person who bears the Masorah with regard to the mitzvahs, the meaning of words, the meaning of context, of concepts. And then you have to ask the halacha. I remember even as a child learning Chumash. You take out an English translation, and we come to the parasha of the birds that are tomei. You have a whole list of translations, and Chazal tell us that we don't know what these species are. The authors of the King James translation seem to have thought that they knew what those birds were. I haven't the vaguest idea what those birds were because my Chumash Malamed didn't know what those birds were. I remember very well as a child. I couldn't have been very old. I remember my father's Zecharono Livracha, Friday night at the table. My mother had made pigeon for Shabbos. and pigeon, it's a yena. It's certainly a nice star. And I remember my father looking at me and saying, a pigeon is a kosher bird. You should know, a pigeon is a kosher bird. It didn't take me very long to realize that, in effect, this is Shalot Yichav Yagedecha. He's passing on the Messiah to the next generation. We don't eat pigeons anymore. I have to make a point of telling my children and grandchildren that a pigeon is an oyster, and if you'll bring me one, I'll be delighted to eat it. If I didn't tell it to them, how in the world would they know that a pigeon is an oyster? They never saw a pigeon on a table in a Jewish home. So the way we have a Messiah is Rabbi Hatzayid, a hunter who was my teacher. He taught me hunting. He told me which is a knife tar, which is not a knife tar. Without a Messiah, I wouldn't know how to translate the words.
And yet, we eat turkey, right?
Oh.
Because we're Saimichon, except there are a few Rabbanim in the world who don't eat turkey. Rav Yankiv didn't eat turkey. His Einikloch didn't eat turkey. But the Rav Kol Yisrael, because we're Saimichon, the Simonim of the Shulchan Aruch, even though there's no Messiah on it.
The Dark Yeshuva indicates that there is a Mishpoch Yidua Berusia that they wrote into the Tznoyim or the Ksuva, that the daughters-in-law wouldn't be Michael their sons and grandsons. They wouldn't be Michael them the turkey.
Right.
Now, the turkey is kind of an anomaly. We basically don't eat anything without a Messiah, and that's relatively late in history. And that's because Chazal gave us synonym of a Neftar. There's an alternative way of knowing what's a Neftar. For reasons that we don't have to go into now, the Rama records Bahalacha that we no longer rely on the Simonim of Chazal, and we eat those birds only on the basis of the Messiah. And you're absolutely right. We have no Messiah whatsoever for a turkey. The turkey is indigenous to the North American continent, and before Columbus, they couldn't have had them in Europe. The Achrenim say that we eat the turkey despite the fact it doesn't have a Messiah, because it was in Spashit in Europe, La Lofim or La Revovais, that we saw, and not a single one of them was Deiris Veichel. They had all of the Simonim of Chazal, and in effect, the acceptance of turkey predates the Ramo, or at least predates the dissemination of the Ramo, of the Shulchan Aruch with the Hagos of the Ramo. So there you're dealing with the simonim. These birds have the simonim of a neftar. It's clear that beginning with the Ramo, there were cheshish that I may just not see that this animal is a deris veichel, that it does whatever it is that a non-kosher animal does with its prey. The fact that I haven't seen it doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
But there are more rayas, Rabak, there are more rayas that this is the real tchelis. There are 10 times as many rayas than that the turkey is kosher.
So I put
it that people that don't eat turkey shouldn't wear tchelis.
And people who eat turkey, I don't know if they should be wearing it either. The mechayis is the fact that they eat turkey is not mechayis.
So let me ask you a little different. It seems that the rayas are very compelling. Even if you feel the rayas are not compelling, people, they take an esrig, they take three esrig, and maybe this one's kosher, maybe this one isn't, maybe this lulav is the right lulav, maybe this isn't. I had an uncle, Shimon Ludmir Zechayel Avrach, he said you used to come every year to buy the esrigim by him, and he used to tell me how you were mahadah with the esrigim, the way you did your esrigim. So I ask you, if people are so medagdic with every possible chumran and mitzvah that's once a year, right, they Chazenish. Maybe it's not a chazenish. Maybe this is a Greek, a Yanova. They shuckle with four esrogim, because maybe this is a murkiv. Maybe this is a miyuchis. Maybe so. Why don't we? Where did tchelis also take it also suffix? Like, well, you could be mekayim your whole life, 365 days, 12 hours a day, a mitzvah deraisa. See, the rayas aren't 100%. They're 80%. What's the downside of it?
The comparison isn't a very good comparison, as the Beis Halevi indicated very well. And that's because, with terms of a Nesrig, we have a Mesiru with regard to what is a Nesrig. Not that those things haven't been questioned by some people. There was a chief rabbi in South Africa. His name was Louis Rabinowitz. He seems to have been very interested in what he called the flora and fauna of Torah, and there was a column that appeared every Friday, every Erev Shabbos in the Jerusalem Post, in which he wrote something about flowers, vegetables, fruit that are described in Tanakh. And one column that made an impression on me, not necessarily with Toiv, was his argument that people here are so being so mahader in not using an Nesrig Amur, because all of our Esregim are Murkovim. Why are they Murkovim? Because the bees cross-pollinate, and who knows where they're bringing the pollen from. Of course, there is a problem with Nesrig Amur, and the point that he raised is certainly a point. And the only response to the point is that in a certain sense, the bee is the Baal HaMesirah. The bee tells me what's an Esrik. If the bee has pollinated an Esrik tree, the fruit of the Esrik tree is the Yetze. It's the Yetze being an Esrik and has a din of an Esrik. It's when humans begin to intervene in what is an unnatural way that we have a tampering with the Esrig that was declared to be the pre-Eitzhoder of Chumash. We know what an Esrig is only because we have a Messiah. The Torah doesn't tell us what an Esrig is. The fruit of a beautiful tree or the beautiful fruit of a tree, whatever pre-Eitzhoder means, but it's not identified in Chumash. Without Torah Shebaal Peh, it's impossible to understand Torah Shebaksav at all. That's the well-known anecdote in the Gemara. The Ger who came to Shammai and said, teach me Torah Shebaksav, I believe you. Torah Shebaal Peh, I don't believe you. And Shammai tells him to go find somebody else. So he goes and he finds Hillel. And Hillel tells him, he begins Aleph Beis Gimel. The next day he comes back for the second shear. And he tells him, Tof Shin Reish Kuf. He tells him exactly the reverse. And this prospective Geir was no fool. He knows he told him exactly the opposite yesterday. To which Hillel tells him that if you rely on me for Torah Shebaksav, you'll have to rely on me for Torah Shebaal Peh as well. Because if I didn't tell you what's an Aleph, you wouldn't know what an Aleph is. If I didn't tell you that an Aleph is an Aleph, you'd tell me that Tof is an Aleph. And that's just not a matter of how to vocalize or to read the letters. There are halachas that dependent upon the letters and the numerical value associated with the letter. There is no Torah Shebaksav without a Torah Shebaal Peh. And a Torah Shebaal Peh is a Mesirah. That's precisely what the Beis Halevi meant. So what the Beis Halevi meant was that without a Mesirah, I don't even have a Sofik. Where I have no Mesirah, I am, if you'll pardon the term, an agnostic. There was a professor of biology in Bar Ilan who he was very, very adamant that what we call rye is not one of the mine dogon at all. That it's something else. It's not one of the grains of Chazal. I know that you make a meitzu lechem minoris on rye and that you have to bench after you eat rye bread because that's what my father showed me. Or better, that's what my grandmother showed me in the kitchen. She was the balas ha-mesirah. We have a mesirah that is part of the mine dogon. There was a very serious shaila this year. I consider it to be a serious shaila. There are some people who are gluten intolerant, and apparently even svelte and oats isn't proper for their diet. And they were using some kind of heirloom grain that was an ancient species of wheat. The wheat that we use today is probably not exactly the same as the wheat of the time of Chumash or even the wheat of Chazal. The scientists will tell you that there are all kinds of different wheats. These are what they call heirloom wheats. And there are people who specialize in this. There's a bakery in my neighborhood that produces bread made of those wheats. And the shaila was whether you could bake matzahs. And their issue was primarily that we don't have a mesira. There, the question, at least in my opinion, hinged to a great extent upon DNA evidence. If the DNA is close enough so that there is enough of the same DNA in our strain of wheat as there is in this alleged ancient form of wheat, then it's presumably the same mean. And that goes to the issue of DNA evidence. DNA evidence may be significant as far as halach is concerned, and that takes us a little bit afield from the topic that we're talking about now. Halacha generally does not accept circumstantial evidence. There are exceptions. The exception is the Tosfos in Shavuos, where the circumstantial evidence, in effect, is deductive. If you have two people enter a cave and you're sure that there's no means of egress and you saw that nobody else entered and one is lying on the floor with a stab wound in his back and the other one is holding a dripping sword and it could not have been a self-inflicted wound, this is evidence that Beis Din can accept. And the reason is because it's deductive. We're not chayshish for mice and nisim. We don't consider that somebody might have been able to pierce rock and enter. But derech hateva, in terms of the natural laws of the universe, this can't happen. The only possible conclusion, logically, is that this person is the murderer and this is his victim. Other forms of evidence, like fingerprint evidence, is nothing more than an empirical generalization. Anyone who knows anything about philosophy of science will tell you that most of science is based upon hypotheses that are derived from empirical generalizations. There is no logical reason why the law of gravity should be a universal principle in the universe. Newton's notion that bodies possessing mass exercise a gravitational pull in direct correlation to the square of the mass is something that was discovered only on the basis of what in simple language is called a trial and error. To put it in simple language, and Newton came up with this, I presume, because one afternoon he went to sleep in an apple orchard and his nap was rudely interrupted by an apple that fell on his head. The next day he decides it's too dangerous here, so he goes into a peach orchard and the same thing happens. And the third day he goes to a coconut orchard and this time it really hurts. So he scratches his head and said, it happened with apples, with peaches, with oranges, with coconuts. Aha, the light goes on. It must be because there's something called gravity, and the Earth is a mass much, much greater than the mass of any one of these little pieces of fruit, and it contracts in direct proportion to its weight as compared to the weight of the object, and therefore the heavier it is, the more it hurts. And lo and behold, you have the principle of gravity. The last person in the world who would have been surprised if somebody had told him, but I went to Gan Eden and I came back with a fruit that defies the rules of gravity. The person who would be least surprised would have been Newton. He would have said, I'll have to go out and hear what the fruit that I know have in common and why this exotic fruit is different. And apparently, the law of gravity isn't universal. It applies only to some things and not to others. That's why circumstantial evidence is not acceptable in halacha. You talk about something like fingerprint evidence. There is no logical reason that two people can't have the same sets of fingerprints. I know why they don't have the same set of fingerprints, because Chazal told us that kishem shein partusayim shovim, kachin deyusayim shovim. The Rebbe Shlomo made everybody with a different face, but apparently it's more than that. He didn't make everybody with just a different face, but even with different fingers. The faces of his fingertips are different, and that's why nobody has the same fingerprint. Why did the Rebbe Shlomo choose to do that? I haven't the vaguest idea. Why didn't he choose to make two people have the same face? How do I know? The Rosh Lailam didn't choose to create the universe in that way. If you will show me two people who have exactly the same parts of, it's not a violation of any law of nature. And you show me two people with the same fingerprints, it's not the violation of the law of nature either.
Sir Bleich, would you not use DNA then in evidence?
DNA is a little bit different. DNA, the jury is out in a certain sense. And that is because in Eretz Yisrael, the Bati Din Rabbanim are in disagreement with regard to the admissibility of DNA evidence. DNA is different from other kinds of circumstantial evidence, not only because of statistical probability. Statistical probability is nothing more than empirical generalization. But because there is an identity, is a DNA stamp that is passed on from one generation to the next. And you have a continuum from parent to child to grandchild through the DNA. And DNA doesn't arise spontaneously, or at least in most cases.
So Rabbi,
we're talking about DNA evidence. You're trying to show me that there is a way of demonstrating that the parent is present in the child and that this is one and the same individual. Now, that doesn't account for mutations because there are mutations.
Rabbi, let me ask you two questions, okay? They found a pair of tzitzis in Masada that has the exact same DNA stamp as the Murex snail, which they believe is the Chelus.
Right. Yes,
so we have a DNA evidence. Let me just, and also the Gemara said, the Paiskim say, in Tfilin, they were Mesupik, if the Halach is like Rabbeinu Tam or Rashi. So they found a pair of Tfilin, the Maril brings, and many of the Paiskim bring it on Kivrei, Shal Yirmiyo, Anavi, and it was written like Rashi, and that's one of the reasons that we Paskin like Rashi. So we see both, we have DNA evidence and we have historical evidence. Here by the Tchelas, we have both DNA evidence and we have the historical evidence from the fact that they...
Let me talk first about Masada. The DNA evidence of Masada is extremely weak as far as Allah is concerned. The people who lived in Masada were meaning. They were sectarians. They were apikursim. Whatever they had there is not what they say in Yiddish, maskeven. It doesn't prove very much of anything. The material that has appeared in the scientific literature in an attempt to identify what they call royal purple is much, much more compelling. We know that Tchelus was very expensive. That's why people engaged in fraudulent practices. They produced fake Tchelus, which is called Kol Ilan. It came from some vegetable substance.
Indigo.
Well, whatever it is, indigo is a color. But whatever the Kol Ilan was, it came from a vegetable substance. It didn't come from the Chalozin. There is no question that the scientists are right with regard to royal purple. And there's no question whatsoever that there was some little creature, probably a sea creature, that was used to produce it. My only problem is that how do I know that what they were using was the Chalozin? It could have been what I would have called a cousin of the Chalozin, very similar in a lot of different ways, and it's not the same species. It's a different species. Just as you could have fruit that is similar to an esrig, and it's not an esrig, for a lot of different reasons, including harkova, including grafting. In this case, you may be dealing with different genealogy.
So what's the downside? Why wouldn't you do it? You've been so many mitzvahs. Why wouldn't you do it?
Why wouldn't I do it?
What's the downside of doing it?
The two reasons. One is that I have no obligation whatsoever. That's all that the Beis HaLevi said, and it turned out to be absolutely correct because he was responding to the Roginer, and it turns out that if there's anything...
It was a fraud. But,
yes,
but the Beis HaLevi...
Nobody engaged the fraud purposely, just to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah.
But it turns out that it wasn't whatever they thought the Tchelus was, but it was the things that they were using in the processing that created...
But the Beis HaLevi says over there there's a negative, Messiah. He says the cuttlefish has been around for 1,000 years, and none of our Zaydis used it. He says, so we have a Messiah that's the incorrect fish. Whereas here, we haven't had the process was lost even by the Goyim for the last 1,400 years. It was discovered in the last number of years. So we do not have the negative Messiah. We have all the shells off the Chelik of Zvulun, off of Tyre, off of Haifa. They have found huge mounds of shell.
That doesn't prove to me it's Trelis. At most it proves, and even that is subject to further investigation, all it proves is that it was prevalent in antiquity and was used in some circles. They're assuming it was used in the royal circles, etc., but even that is, to the best of my knowledge, not established with certainty. All that they are proving is that there was something similar to Trelis. Whether it's actually Trelis or not has not been demonstrated and can't be demonstrated other than on the basis of the Torah. I think that was real, that the Beis HaLevi's really significant point was that we are Torah people. And if we don't have a Torah, we have no obligation.
Well, we lost the Torah of Tzilin, and we still have Tzilin.
We haven't lost the Torah of Tzilin by any means.
Well, we lost it in the time of Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. There was a disagreement how to do it.
It was sure there was a disagreement.
So it was clearly there was a loss of the Messiah.
And what did Rashi's father wear? And what did Rabbeinu Tam's father wear?
Rabbeinu Tam was an Einikel of Rashi.
I know he was an Einikel.
So obviously the Messiah was lost.
How could the Messiah have been lost?
I don't know. But
people were putting on tefillin. There were clearly differences of opinion that predated both Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Neither Rashi nor Rabbeinu Tam would have taken upon himself to say that every pair of tefillin that we've had for generations is possible and that the tefillin have to be written some other way. That would have been a direct contradiction to the Messiah. Obviously, this was something that was a matter of some doubt with conflicting traditions of one kind or another, and you have each one trying to substantiate one particular position with regard to what the authentic tefillin should be. It's quite different from the case with regard to the Trelis. I think that Beis HaLevi's real point was that we don't tamper with the Messiah, nor do we create a Messiah where there is none. And in the absence of a Messiah, there is no obligation whatsoever. If there is no obligation whatsoever, al tistak arba, it's yetzis chori b'hesoidei. I think that his basic underlying lesson was that this is Shavuos, the Yontif of Matan Torah, it's the Yontif of the Messiah. Torah Shebaal Peh comes together with Torah Shebaksav, and we don't even try to understand Torah Shebaksav without a Torah Shebaal Peh. And Torah Shebaal Peh and this Messiah, this tradition from generation to generation, are synonymous. And otherwise,
Turkey is the exception, you say?
No, Turkey is not an exception, because Chazal told us we can rely on Simonim. People later became firmer than Chazal, if I may use the expression. Chazal said to rely on their criteria, their Simonim, their symptoms of what is a Eif Tahor, and we were Cheshish because, for whatever reason, primarily because we're city folk for the most part, and we don't really know these birds, and et cetera. And for all we know, just because we haven't seen that they are theirs, it doesn't mean that some members of the species aren't theirs. And later, when the Schumra of the Ramo became widespread, the turkey had long been accepted. And it's not just because it was grandfathered in. It was because they saw not only dozens and hundreds, but in the words of the Achronim, alofim ravovois, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and no one has ever seen a single one that's theirs. So, and turkey was extremely common, and that's why it was accepted. It's not against the Messiah. It's because Chazal told us that in this case, you don't need a Messiah. The same thing that I said with regard to the other non-kosher birds in Chumash, we haven't the vaguest idea what they are. The stones, the jewels that were used on the Chesh and the Ephod. Again, the King James translators seem to believe they know what it is. or they knew what it was in Latin, and somebody translated it into English, and they thought they knew what it was in English. As far as we're concerned, we don't have a Masoret. I haven't the vaguest idea what those are. And I've had the experience of discovering that there are certain schools that they try to teach the children the English definition of each one of the stones in the Cheshen of the Kohen Gadol. And my reaction is a chuckle. You're teaching them what the English translation told you is the meaning of these words in the Chumash. And how did they know? It's Arvach Arvat Zorach. We don't have a Masoret for the identity of those Avonim. And if we don't have a Masoret, then the fact that we're teaching is incorrect. We have no business to try to teach people that this is what the word means if we don't know what the word means. And I think that that's basically what the Beis HaLevi meant to say, that if we don't have a Masoret, we can't tell people that we do, and it doesn't even create a suffix. Without a Masoret, we know nothing. If somebody will come and somehow be able to tell me that what we have found is munach b'chesom yishol kain gadol, like the pach shemen that the Chashmonaim found, and they knew that this was a cruse of oil that didn't become tome because it had the seal of a kain gadol, if you will, you know, have a container.
Well, that's also not a Masoret, though. But there's no Masoret in that either, then.
You'll have to have a Masoret for the signature of the Kohen Gadol. You'll have to be Mekayim the Chesima. If you'll come and be made, this is Chelis, then I know it's Chelis. If Leo Anovi will come, he'll tell me this is Chelis. If you will find some way, so, I don't know how you would do this, as I said, if you have a Chesima of the Kohen Gadol, which you were Mekayim with two other Chesimas of the Kohen Gadol, obviously an impossibility, then we can talk about historical evidence. That becomes acceptable historical evidence.
You're saying, Rabbi, basically you're saying that simanim of hakim do not help. We need a Masoret that's midor l'dor, and simanim of hakim would not help.
Or betchelus, simanim and hakim, says the Beis HaLevi, won't help.
So my question is, where did the Beis HaLevi get this new yisod?
It's not a new yisod.
Kala Tyra Kula Musimanim of Hakim help. You could be Matar and Aguna, you could be Matar
and
Asia Sish with Simanim of Hakim.
Okay. Because Isha Daiku Minsuva is a different principle entirely.
Entire Tyrus Simanim of Hakim help, but you could be Maitzi Mamin with Simanim of Hakim, but for Tcheles, you need a Messiah. Where does this site come from?
I'm defining a term. I don't know the definition of the term. Chumash is a Sefer Chosum. Every word of Chumash needs a translation. Moshe Rabbeinu gave Torah Shebiksav with a lexicon, and he had to explain the meaning of every word. Every word is used in a very narrow, technical, halachic sense. And he's identifying trelis as trelis. You have to know precisely what species the trelis is derived from.
But says Raya, but I'll give you an example of one of the Raya. I'll give you an example. The Gemara says, there's only two things that have the exact same color. The Gemara says Kala Ilan, which is the indigo tifineras. It's a type of a plant which they use for blue jeans.
Yeah.
And it says and the chilazain. The only two colors we know from nature today, right, using all the colors of antiquity, are the Kala Ilan and the chilazain. They're the exact same color. They're indistinguishable. Right, so we're using a simon from the Gemara, right?
You seem to believe that we have a Masoret for Kola Ilon.
Kola Ilon is indigo. It's the name of a plant.
So. Are you sure that what they're using in making jeans is Kola Ilon?
Yes.
You think, no.
There's only one plant in the world that gives blue.
I'm not aware of that.
No?
I'm not aware that there's only one
that's
plant.
That's what Google says.
I'm not aware of that.
There's only one plant in the world that this blue comes from. It's called Indigofera tinctoria.
Okay, that's what they're using today for that color. I'm not sure that it's the color of Kol Ilan once upon a time. You think that even that wasn't subject to change, mutation, et cetera, over a period of centuries? I'm not sure that even if it's the same plant, that it looks the same as it did once upon a time. There are other things that have changed over a period of time. The color of blue jeans. I don't see my unscientific observation. Not all blue jeans look alike by any means. Not all of them have the same color. Even the blue jeans. I'm not talking about the takeoffs that have different kinds of color altogether. But I suspect very strongly that there are different ways that you can get whatever it is that dyes the blue jeans dye.
I'm just telling you that there are 10 rayas of this sort of bleich. They're all from the Gemara. They're not made up.
Those rayas don't mean very much.
Okay.
Because arvach arvatsoris. You can't compare apples and oranges unless you first identified the apple and identified the orange. For that, I need a Messiah. I need a Messiah to tell me this is an apple and a Messiah to tell me this is an orange. And then we'll see whether they're one the same or they're not one the same. That is clearly the position of the Beis Halevi. You accept the Beis Halevi. Obviously, the Regina didn't accept the Beis Halevi. And apparently, there are people out there who didn't either. But I look around and I see that Rav Binyan of people whose opinions count are not wearing trellis. And the only explanation is that either they're aware of the Beis Halevi explicitly, or that they have on their own intuitively discovered what the Beis Halevi said, and they're acting accordingly.
Well, it's been a very big honor to have you with us, and we thank you very much for your most valuable time. Thank you very much, Rabbi Bleich.
Thank you, call to.
We have it with us on the phone from Eretz Yisrael, Harav HaGoyin Reb Nachum Eisenstein, who is a Mishamish B'Kodesh and a Talmud of the Paisik HaDoyer Rav El Yashiv for many years. He's also the Rav of Malot Afna, and he's also the head of the Vad HaRabonim L'Nyon Egeris. He was put there by Moran Rebel Yashiv Zuchayin Lavracha. Welcome, Reb Nachum.
Welcome to all the listeners, and especially to Yedidi Me'oz, Reb David.
So, Hagayin Reb Nachum, tell us, there are so many proofs, maybe 15 proofs, that the Tchelis that we have today is the real Tchelis. And from the fact that Chazal say it grew with its shell, from the fact that it says it grew in the Sfunei Tzmunei Chayil, in the sand, in the thing. From the fact that the Rambam in the Pirush HaMishnayos in Kelim calls it a tzedef, which is a type of a clam, to the type that the fact that it's brought in Chazal many times that it was Liad Sidon and Haifa, and that's where they found historically masses of the shells, to the fact that they found Tchelas in Masada, and they did a DNA test on it, and they said it comes from the Murex snail. I mean, I have pages of rayas here. I can't imagine any Rav wouldn't be Mater and Arguna with these rayas. So then, additionally, very powerful thing, a lot of people are mistaken, and they think, oh, Tchelas, Lava, and Einim Akfen Zoezu, but Rashi and the Ramban say clearly, you're only Mekayim, one of the two mitzvahs, which means it's a real bittel of mitzvah tchelis. So given the fact that we have with Zeicha in the last 20, 30 years, 40 years, whatever it is, to the scholars of the tchelis, why don't some more people wear it?
Okay, just to answer your last question first, then we'll get back to the first question, and that's not out of order, because we know many times that Gemara answers the last question before going back to the first question, is that the reason why Baruch Hashem, I say, is that many more people don't wear it, is that the Gedolei Yisrael, who definitely are aware of all these riots, etc., they said clearly not to wear tchelis. All these things were presented to them, and if they said clearly not to wear tchelis, so it's a mitzvah gdoila ma'oid lishmoya ledivei chachamim. That's a much bigger mitzvah than a mitzvah kiyumis of tchelis on the tzad that is tchelis. So Baruch Hashem, the roiv minyan ubinyan from Bnei Torah in the world do not wear tchelis, because that was the shita from Maran Rav Yoshev, which you yourself said now he was the poysik ador, and therefore every Ben Torah is really obligated to listen to the poysik. Gador, but everyone held like that. The Shlomo Zalman held like that. Rav Osner held like that. Rav Moshe held like that. You can tell me Rav Moshe was a different kufi. He wasn't aware of all the riots, but there's no question about it. Rav Moshe would have not make up something which the Mesoyeris is bottle, and we have to follow the Mesoyeris. The Mesoyeris of Tchelis was bottle, and since the Mesoyeris of Tchelis was bottle, until the Mesoyeris was reestablished by Chazal, then we have no right with all these riots. With all these riots, maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but we cannot reestablish a Mesoyeris based on scientific evidence.
Let me respond to this. The Maril clearly says, he says if it would be refound, he would do it again. So the Maril said that even though there's no Mesoyeris, it wouldn't impede him if we were to find the Tchelis. Right?
Let me add on.
In Hilchos Tefillin it's brought, one of the rayas that was Seimach on Rashi and not Rabbeinu Tam, is that they found on top of the caver of Yirmiyah, they opened the box, they found an old pair of tefillin, and the tefillin were written Keseda of Rashi. And this is brought by all the Paiskim as one of the reasons to be Seimach Rashi. So you see, even though the Mesoyeris was lost, the fact that they had a historical raya, not unlike finding the Tchelis in Masada now and doing a DNA. So, you see, I'm bringing you a Maril, I'm bringing you a halachic significance in the Mesoyeris of Tefillin, which seemingly was lost, that they brought a raya from a historical fact.
First of all, there's no raya whatsoever from Tefillin, because a pair of Tefillin was found, and was found that was written according to the Shita of Rashi. So it's not that they put together that this, or 15 riyas, like you said, that this is Tchelis, that this is a pair of tefillin which was found, which is not a question of a historical fact. It's a metzias that it was a pair of tefillin. And they saw it was written, an old pair of tefillin, was written with the, was written on Pishitas Rashi. That's one.
But the Tchelis in Masada, the Tchelis in Masada is real Tchelis.
First of all, if you learn your history properly, and again, I'm not a book in history, it's questionable who these people in Masada were. It's a question which group of people they belonged to. We know there were all kinds of different groups of people after the Beis Hamikdash who had all kinds of tzedukim, etc., etc. But again, all these riots which you're telling me, which again I'm not going to argue with you because this is not the place to argue. I go back to my original statement, which was very clear. And I think that Baruch Hashem, most B'nai Torah, Rav Minyan and Binyan, we're talking about 95%, if not more, that the mitzvah Shmoy Gedol Yisrael, the Poisek Ador, the Poisek Ador, all the Gedolim of this door, they know all this information. Don't think they don't know it. Anyone thinks they don't know it, that's a pasha that itself is also a bizarre and a disgrace to the Aruch of Mitzvah L'Shmoy Yediv HaChamim. They said in a very clear way not to wear Tchelis. I think there's nothing more to discuss. And it's worse than that. Anyone who wears Tchelis, anyway, so besides the fact that he shows that he thinks he's smarter than the Gedol Yisrael, and he thinks he knows better, but it's a very, very dangerous thing. And the people who push Tchelis now are very aggressive. They're very aggressive. And the bottom line is they're teaching people you do not have to listen to Gedol Yisrael because we know better. We can make up a new Mesoyeris. And I've done some investigation, and I found a direct correlation. A very direct correlation. And the Tchelis people, who are these aggressive Tchelis people, which are some of them are Talmidei Chachamim, they're fine people, but they went astray a little with not listening to Gedol Yisrael. And they admit that there's a direct correlation between the Tchelis people and the people go to Har HaBayis. The Harabayas has the exact same problem. There are certain places in the Harabayas which a person is allowed to go. However, there's other places in the Harabayas which is the chorus. We don't have an exact Masoiris, exactly how to measure and where to measure from. Ramosha, the Poisek Ador, mentions this already in one of the earlier volumes of Igros Moshe, that we lost the Masoiris exactly how and where to count. I mean, the people going counting is based on also archaeological evidence from the Goyim, and they come and they know better.
Respectfully, to go up to the Harabayis is not a mitzvah. You're not Mekayim anything. Here, every time you put on a beged of dalad konfis, it's a bitl asei biyadayim. So, even if we would agree that places to go on the Harabayis, what do you need it for? What's selfish there is?
You're 100% right. If a person really has proper kavanah to daven, where every daven's a kosh bohu, if he has proper kavanah, he'll accept his tefillahs. Most of these people go on Harabayis don't even daven. Many of the people don't even call themselves from. But it's here in their sentence. I'm telling you now, and this is the point which I want to make clear, that this is leading to things that Tchelus leads to, we can make a reestablish lost Masoiris. It leads to go up to higher bias, like what you say, there's nothing to gain from it.
But you see,
because of these Tchelus people, they're the exact same people are pushing Harabayis, even though, like you say, there's no purpose in going up to Harabayis if they're smaller Sufik. And tomorrow they'll do this, and the next day afterwards, it's a very, very dangerous movement. The people know better than anyone else, and they don't listen to Gdeli Yisrael, and it's a thing which has to be stopped. And everyone knows in the proper Dalet Amos of Bnei Torah, people who respect the Gdeli Ador, the Poiski Ador, that anyone who goes with Tchelis, he's putting a red scarlet on his bag and saying, ha, I know better than you. I fight for the Gdeli Ador. And it's a chutzpah. Pasha the chutzpah, anyone who goes with Chalas is saying that I know better than the Gedali Ador.
So Ramachem, let's continue then. By the way, about the Masoiris, the Beis Halevi writes, when he writes to the Radzina Rebbe, the first one who tried to be Mechadish at Chalas, he writes that there's a Masoira against the cuttlefish, which was the fish that the Radzina took it from. He says, because the cuttlefish was commonly found for all the generations, and the fact that our Zaydis and the Rabbanim that preceded us did not use the cuttlefish is a raya that it's the wrong one. So he implied implicitly that if they would find a new Hamtza, which there was no negative anti-Masaira against, he would have been maskim to. But he says, if they knew about this fish and they didn't use it, clearly it's not the Tchela. So I'm just showing you the Beis Halevi himself did not seem to tie it to Masaira.
Okay, so Rav Yashav, let me tell you, Rav Yashav always used to quote this Beis Halevi. And he says with the 15 scientific proofs, the proofs that you have today, he says tomorrow someone's going to come and he'll come up with 30 proofs that it's something else. So that's, and then 10 years later, someone, and this was happening, it was the Regina, and even today there's two different types of trailers which people are marketing. There's this trailers and that trailers. Baruch Hashem, I'm not a mumcha because as far as me, all trailers is the same thing. It's an open attack against Gedali Yisrael to say, I know better.
So let's go back. So why wouldn't Rebbe Yashiv accept the 15 rayas?
Because the Masoiris was lost. And if tomorrow you have 15 rayas, and this is what he told me clearly, that the next day, in another year, or who knows when, they'll come up with 30 rayas and it's something else.
So let's assume...
Simple as that.
I understand, but look, you have a DNA raya from a historical event. You have the big mounds off of Tzidain. You have, there's really strong riots. You can't make up new riots. So let me ask you another question. So let me ask you another question. At the very least, it should be a Safik Daraisa. And we know the Mishnah Berurah L'Mashal writes that if somebody has a tefillin that he's unsure of whether they're kosher or not, He says you put them on, al safik deraisa, even if after you put them on, you don't know if you were yaitz to the mitzvah, because safik deraisa. So why wouldn't we? People take, how many esregim does an average young man go? He buys 3 esregim, maybe this is a murkiv, maybe this is not, maybe this is, here, it's not one time a year, it's one, the mitzvah's esreg is one, the first day is a deraisa, out of, maybe outside of Yerushalayim for sure, it's just the first day. So people go, they're shopping for esregim and esregim. Here you could be mekayim every day of your life in other mitzvah. Why don't you say safek deraisa l'chumra on it?
For the simple reason, again, and I think, Reb David, you're missing the point. The point is that if you have a tefillin, which is a safek, it's kosher safek, no, we know that there's a mitzvah of tefillin, and it was havalachas, and we know how to make tefillin. So here's a shaila with a tefillin, a kosher, not, a valik vis, is a safek deraisa, you have to put on the tefillin just if you have a safek and dalad minim also. But over here, since the mesoyrus was lost, we cannot be mechavish the mesoyrus, and by the mechavish the mesoyrus, which even though it might be right, it might be the right chalas, but we lost the mesoyrus, and by doing this, it's very, very dangerous. It's very dangerous because the tomorrow there'll be, not tomorrow, this is already yesterday, they were mechavish the mesoyrus, the kilu, they know how to go in harabayas, and then the next day they'll say something else, and because of that, things which we don't know clearly has a din of chodesh osam and a Torah, and Rav Yosef was very, very machpi about this. Aske de kach, when this mesoyrus started becoming a little more popular, must have been 10 years ago, I can't tell you the exact year, but when I first discussed it with him, he told me definitely Pasha, there's no Shiley, told me the Beis Halevi then, and then even family members ask him what to do, and he tells, tell everyone I don't wear tchelis. And then afterwards, and I asked him to write me a letter then, to write a letter because I saw that this magefa was spreading, and he told me it's not necessary to write a letter. But you'll see, several years later, he did write a letter. Did write a letter which was published. It was written to the Grand Rafael Cohen in America. And after he saw that this magefa was spreading so much, and Rabbi Yosef didn't like writing letters, but he saw that people were doing things which could have, which may eventually come to Dvarim Chamurim. Like you say, wearing tchelis is not the end of the world. Maybe Mekayim the Mitzvah, and maybe not Mekayim the Mitzvah, and there's really no Isser involved. That's for sure not. It's besides the Isser of the Mitzvah Shmuel Adim. But it's a very, very dangerous trend, and it has to be stopped.
So can I ask you a question? Can you think of an example in Halacha where the Gedolim, or a Gadol, or a Paisik, is Mevatel, a Mitzvah Saseh B'Yadayim, because he's afraid there would become a Michshel out of it?
No one's being Mevatel anything. We're not being Mechadish new things. And we know that the klal is the chodesh osam and the Torah. So no one is being mevatel anything. The mesoyrus for many years was, since there was no mesoyrus, was not to wear tchelis, and it's not being mevatel. People want to institute tchelis now. They're making chodesh. They're making something else. So it's not that we're being mevatel. It's not that the Gedolei Yisrael are being mevatel. The Gedolei Yisrael continuing doing what their fathers did, the Zaydis did, and the Elder Zaydis did.
Let me ask you one last question. We'll move on to a new topic. It seems from the Rishonim that there was a period where the Mesoyra and Tefillin was lost. Right? And they had to bring Rayas that, like Rabbeinu Tam or like Rashi, would have there been a tzad at that point not to wear Tefillin because the Mesoyra was lost?
Definitely not, because there was no Tefillin is not a thing which is a Mesoyrus. Tefillin is a din in the Gemara, it says how to write the Parshas, the Machlekes of Rishonim, how to do it, Rabbein Tam and Rashi, etc. But it's not a thing which is taught in the Mesoyrus. In the Mesoyrus, it's a halacha, how to do it. But it's not something which is taught in the Mesoyrus. There's no comparison to Tefillin to Tchelis.
Hagoyin Ramachem, it's always a great honor to have you with us.
And it's also a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to speak to you, because it's you give me an opportunity. You give me the opportunity to vent my good for my health also, to get out what things I feel are being done against the Gedolei Hapoiskim, which I discussed of being Mishamish Yoyim Yoyim for 25 years.
Thank you very much. In closing, what does it say? We have many rayas for tchelis. what seems to be the main reason why not, those who don't, is because they say we just somehow lost the tradition. We don't have the ability to regain a tradition, even if we have ample proof. I leave it to you, my brilliant, amazing group of co-listeners, to say, I don't know, should we be Mekayim Mitzvos Chelos? Signing off this week, Parsha Shlach, the Parsha of Tzitzis. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio.